Mike O'Mara, Radio Entertainment. You can listen to The Mike O'Mara Show at MikeO'MaraShow.com.
Well, what have we here?
It's a podcast.
Fine.
And what excitement we have today.
It's The Mike O'Mara Show with Mike O'Mara and Rob Spiewak. Now, here's Mike.
And welcome, everybody, to a special episode of The Mike O'Mara Show as we are all here along with director Dylan Narang, who directed the movie Tapawingo. Now, we've talked about the movie in the past. We know someone who's in the movie, but we've had a chance to see the movie, and we have our
questions. We know someone, and I am so jealous.
Yes, indeed.
I mean, Chad's not only is Chad younger than I am, but Chad, Chad doesn't know this. You guys might know this.
Chad Dukes, of course.
Chad yeah. Dukes of, you know, of the Chad Dukes experience, Wonder, the convenience store, whatever he's got, all the stuff he's got. He's been on this show. Big Owen Duke show back in the day on the same radio station I was on. But my bucket list was being a movie. Anyway, Chad was fantastic in it, by the way. The movie Tapawingo, and the director Dylan Narang is with us right now. And Dylan, I don't know where to start because I've gotten a lot of screeners in my day, but I've never had a screener where I watched it right up until maybe a minute and a half before I came into the studio.
Yeah, we just delayed the recording so you could finish it up.
And it confused me because I don't know where to begin and I don't want to give spoilers and I want to make sure. Let me just say that I would describe my experience of watching this film like watching something you would see on the side of the highway that you just can't. It's not a car wreck is the bad thing to say. What it is like something you can't stop. It's like almost like a guilty pleasure, and that is, and it builds, and it's a comedy, and it's got an amazing cast, a use of the cast that is just, I can't define it. You're going to get a lot of people's talking about Napoleon Dynamite because of the star and
because
the script.
You watch it, and knowing while you're watching it, you know this is going to be even funnier the second time and third time through.
It's got some moments in it. It's got, and I am not blowing smoke here, as far as directing goes, Dylan, it is obvious to me you worked your ass off on this film because I don't know how many different shots I looked at from a film major's perspective, but boy, you look at the movie's something to behold. I don't know. How would you describe it? I'm going to put it on you. How would you describe Tapawingo?
Yes.
Okay. Well, look, first, thank you guys for having me, Mike. Thanks for having me. And it's very, very kind words that you all are saying. How would I describe it? Look, I think I wanted to make a movie like the kind of movies I like to watch and that I can put on repeat all the time and I always gravitate to. You know, there's something to be said for all the awardsy stuff and dramatic stuff. That stuff's all great, but, you know, I got enough of that stuff going on in my life. Like, I want to throw on a movie that I'm like, it's fun. It's quotable. It's in the background or it's not or all those kinds of things. It just feels like something that you would want to watch over and over, like Josh said.
It's something else. It really is.
Yeah. I think also it feels like if I could throw in anything, any of those themes of like, for me, it's supposed to feel like, I know we're all pretty removed from it, but like when you left high school and left for college or wherever, it was that last bit of you don't really have a responsibility, right? You're kind of free for a little bit. You have that kind of feeling of, and you're looking at this big, exciting adventure you're about to start, whatever that is. And it's that moment right before that happens where you're so excited and so looking forward to it. But it's also a little bittersweet because of what you're leaving behind. Mm-hmm. If you can wrap your head around that. And it happens at other times in life, too. But I wanted to invoke that in the movie, which I was hoping made its way in. That was kind of what I was trying to do in terms of giving it some feeling and giving it something that we can all kind of grasp onto, but also be fun and funny and, you know, all those things.
You know, it really does. It is silly. It does capture that mood. And I have to ask two questions. First off, is it on purpose set in the past or does it just evoke the past?
It is on purpose in the past. I thought, you know, look, there's practical reasons why you would shoot whatever you're shooting. Mm-hmm. The whole reason to shoot it is not to get away from cell phones. Like, I didn't say, let's do the 70s so we don't have cell phones. But that is one of those things that the time period of when this movie feels like it could work felt like it would be at a time in the past. For me, it's always been in the mid-70s, maybe late 70s. I've heard other people attack me that it's like 82 or 83, and I'm like, okay.
I mean, it's fine. It's the right time frame where you don't have technology that's now outdated to distract you.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah, and it all runs together when you're my age, because you look at that and you just say to yourself, 70s, it could be the 80s, it could be the 90s. I think that the giveaway, of course, the princess phone, the ultimate star of
beautiful
the movie.
Thing.
But it's fun.
Another thing about evoking that era, and I don't know if it was just me. I was struck from the first frame by the color of the movie.
Right.
It is almost, I don't want to say surreal, but over the top color. And sometimes when you think back on that era and that moment in your life, you're imagining it the way you remember it, not the way it was.
100%.
Did you go on purpose with the color really intense like that?
Yes, I did. I think anytime you're looking back at fonder memories or that, usually the colors are a little brighter or whatever. Yeah. But for me, so that is a given foundational statement. But also, I think the kind of films that I respond to, whether it's a comedy or not, do have the colors pumped a little bit, do feel a little warmer and a little bit more inviting and all those kinds of things. And I think for a comedy, you know, some people have asked me, at times, why did you shoot it this way? Why is it center punch? Why do you have whip pans or zooms and all this stuff? One, because that stuff's really fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's really fun.
Yeah,
to do.
The cinematography in the movie is fun.
Yeah,
and you get that right away. I would imagine when you're talking about this film that you would immediately be barraged with the questions about Napoleon Dynamite and the comparisons to that. I mean that you had to be aware that that was going to be coming when you made this movie, right?
I did, and I kind of like threw it out because look, I think. One, that kind of style works for me for comedies, especially. I think a lot of comedies could work better with that. And some of them try and some of them don't. Whether it's big studios and they want everything in the basic style of filmmaking, like a the master shot and then oners or overs, over mediums, closer. Like that's what they do and maybe an insert. That's the basic concept. For me, doing center punch and whips and all that stuff just feels more fun and feels like it works for comedy. So that's one of the reasons I also saw it. I also see movies like that a lot. Where I'm like, this could work better, or this is how I want to make this movie. But let's not fool ourselves. If you're making like a horror movie, it might not work as well. I'm not sure. But anyway, as far as Napoleon and all that stuff goes, Mike, you're always going to have a reference of what you're doing, right? Like, I don't know anyone who's just like, this is random stuff coming from my brain that no one. It just, I had references, and my references were Napoleon. They were Jared Hess movies. Wes Anderson movies, Edgar Wright movies, and then this is gonna be so bad. It's the Naked Gun, Top Secret, Airplane. Is that the
Abrams and Zucker?
Yeah, the Zucker brothers. Like, I was all of that, and other comedies that we've seen. So it's not just Napoleon Dynamite.
Right.
I think it's all of that stuff uses this same kind of storytelling and filmmaking of center punch, whips, zooms. They all kind of do that. And in the 70s, this was the filmmaking. This is how you made movies with these tools of center punch, whip, zoom. So I'm setting it in the 70s. It felt like it made sense on top of being a comedy, on top of pumping the primary colors. So I'm sure we're going to get comparisons. The other one is just because we have John.
Yeah.
Who is amazing, right?
He's great.
Such a good actor and underrated, right? He still works, but he's so underrated because he's so good. So good to have on set, a good attitude, really talented, puts in a lot of extra work. You know, when we started, so I should tell you the story at some point if you're interested, but the script was written in 2009 by Brad DiMaria. And it came to my company in like 2011, the first company I started after film school. And the interns loved it, and I didn't. I was like, he had a little reel that he was going to do. He wanted to direct it. And I guess you know, the interns loved it, and it just didn't connect with me. I kept trying and trying and trying, you know, 10 pages, 20 pages, and it just didn't work for me. And I think one, that was also because I was looking at it from the perspective of a director. I went to school for directing, but right. that job was your producing, which is a little different because you can only see it as it needs to be this way for it to work, mm-hmm. not whatever this is.
Right.
And so every couple of years, I would keep checking on it. Every 3 or 4 years, I'd call the agent or whoever it was, what's going on with the script? I know I remembered my interns really liked it. I wonder if there's something to do. And after 3 to 4 attempts of that and 10 years, I finally said, what the crap am I doing? Mm-hmm. The dude's email is on here. Brad's email is on the script. I'll just email him. And it was very lucky, very surreptitious, not made up, whatever we want to call it. I emailed him. He said, I can't believe you emailed me. The job, the email is for a job. I'm leaving today. I've just taken a job at the University of Virginia. My family moves Sunday. It was a Friday. I can't believe you want to do anything with this. Feel free. Do whatever you want. Just like that. And he was moving to Virginia. I'm from Virginia. I went to University of Virginia. My daughter was at University of Virginia at the time. So then it became, I'm visiting her or dropping her off for school, and then we can talk. And it was pretty quick. I was like, hey, do you mind if I rewrite some of it? He's like, yeah. That's totally
cool. Where's the movie shot, most of it? More of the outdoor scenes?
Near Richmond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was, as far as the other thing that jumps out at me is the casting of the movie is mind-numbing. Of course, I'm fascinated with fellow podcaster Chad Dukes and his involvement and how he got involved
so
in it. And yeah. And as I think, Josh, you had mentioned last week on the show that, you know, when you're watching it and you produce and consult for Chad and have known him for a long time,
yeah,
you're not looking. You're not looking at Chad, and it's just it's amazing. And the moment I love is the first time you see Chad with Billy Zane, who is silent and phenomenal. Just because he's got the gravitas that he brings to everything he does. The casting, can you talk a little bit about what went into that, how it came about? Because the casting has. And mention some of the actors that are, because there's so many actors from TV.
My favorite is Tom Rohn.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Absolutely. Go back to him, yes.
Ratzenberger is really good. Like, I mean, they're all really good. That's the thing, right? They're all really, Chad Dukes, amazing in the movie. Like, he's just so good, like, embodies that character. The casting, Mike, when Brad first was trying to make it on his own as a director, he had Martin Starr. I think he had Martin Starr attached. And the kids were younger, right? They were like in their 20s. Nate was in his 20s, early 20s. And that was one of the changes I made. You know, it had been 10 years, but I was also like,
okay,
this doesn't feel sense. Like, this doesn't feel like it makes sense. If he's 21, 23, 24, and he's living at his mom's, it's not great, but it's like, okay. I mean, I feel like that happens. Now, if he's mid 30s, what are you doing? Right. So I think there was some of that needed to be different. And there's a part at the end that we should talk at some point we'll talk about that needed to be different. But there was stuff all around. And he had Martin Starr. Martin Starr was no longer with it when I finally got to it. And we started looking around, me and my casting director, Alan Hooper, who's very, very good. And we were batting around names, trying to figure it out. And in the back of our mind was always John. But we thought, you're never going to get John. And it's similar to Napoleon. Like, you're not going to get Napoleon, you know, Napoleon to play Napoleon again. Like
again.
And we went through, we had at least one really good actor attached, but I've made enough of these to know how much time I need to make a good movie. If you don't have enough time, you don't get all those shots. It's very bare bones and very quick. And I knew, I map out everything when I make a movie, like shot to shot, edit to edit. I know I need this shot. It's going to cut to this one. It's going to cut. Like, I do that whole bit because in indie film, you can't just shoot miles of everything and hope it works out. Like, you have to figure out exactly what your bits are for the puzzle. And that first actor just wanted to give us like 18 days, and I knew I needed more than that. And then we just said, hey, why don't we just try? Let's just try for John and see what happens. And it didn't take long. He was like, yeah, this looks great. I'll do it. And because we had John, that made it, we ended up getting Billy. I have a really good story about Billy that I can't tell you until after. So I know that's terrible, but I will tell you, it's a good one. we got Billy because we had John, because they were working on Waltzing with Brando together, which hadn't shot. They were just planning on doing it. And they had talked a little bit here and there. And it was COVID, so everything was getting pushed, and they didn't know when they were going to do it. But that's why we got Billy, because Billy was like, oh, you have John? Okay, well, I want John for my movie, so I'll come on. Gina came on because we had John. Most of the actors came on. Yeah, Gina Gershon.
Also in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Most of the actors came on because of John. They all wanted to work with John.
That's fun.
Can I ask you a question about John while we're on?
Yeah, let me just mention we're talking to Dylan Narang, the director of a brand new movie that I hope everybody gets to see. It's called Tapawingo, and it's a real romp. It's a fantastically funny comedy and a romance, I have to say that as well. And I hope I don't come across as that much of a dirty old man when I say I was a bit smitten by the lead female character. Gretchen is her character's name. But go ahead, Rob.
And it starts streaming December 2nd.
December 2nd.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. I was also smitten by John Heder, which is why I want to ask this question. for the comedy.
Mention the character, too.
Okay, his name is Nate Skoog.
Yep.
Yes.
Nate Skoog. For the character of Nate Skoog, for a comedy, this has got such marvelous pacing all the way through. It doesn't feel rushed. And when there is a laugh, there is a good, good pause for it. The timing is just right. But so many of the laughs are just watching Nate Skoog's face react. And he takes his time on the reactions.
He does. Sometimes you really have to wait. Even when you'll just get a little shake of the head, which is kind of fun. I like the movie. I mean, I really did. I'm sitting here fresh off of it, and I'm still formulating an opinion on it. It builds, but go ahead, Rob.
When you do a shot, and his entire shot is maybe three expressions that dissolve into another, and it tells an entire story. As director, is it fun to watch him work with that, or did you have to hold his hand? Did you see eye to eye on the pacing of his character? Because it's almost addictive. His silence in the movie is so great.
So it's an interesting question, because I don't want to offend John. John is a really, really good actor. Like I said, he's amazing. He can do it. You stick him out there, he's gonna get it done. I think the difference between one of the differences, at least for me, with John and maybe another actor, is he was also very receptive to, hey, man, I kind of want it this way. Hey, can we do it this way? And you kind of do that a couple times. And he's like, hey, Dylan, just tell me how you want me to say it. And I was like, all right, it needs to be like, that's the way I play it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like that his read on it was, that's the way I play it.
That's
the way I play it. And I was like, I want you to put emphasis here for it. Do it this way. Or on the part where... Oswald says, don't tell Gretchen I'm paying you guys. She doesn't know. What does it matter if she knows or not? She's Tarwater's sister, dummy. And then we swing around and John's eyes are like really wide.
Mm-hmm.
I had to do that a couple times to say, I want you to make them wider than you've ever made them in your entire life. So there's a little bit of that, but he's really good at taking those kinds of directions. I think there's actors that would really be upset over a line read or, you kind of performing something out in front of them. So there was some of that, and there's some that he's John. He gets it. He's, again, a really good attitude, so it's easy to do. It's easy to get through it.
How much, when you're working, you always hear, I often hear interviews with directors that refer to their style of directing. You hear actors talk about it as well. Are you somebody that gives notes continually? Are you somebody that lets it happen? Would you have a particular style that you emulate when you're directing? What do you do as a director?
Really interesting question. I'm going to try to break it down, but I may not even get to it. I think the first thing is you have to let the actor have a take. If you try to, they have an idea of what the scene's about, and then we go try to do it. If you're already noting them before they even start a take, it's going to be a mess. You have to at least see something so you can say, all right, where do we want it to go from here? You can give a little bit more guidance at the beginning of what the scene's about, or maybe what the blocking is. But I think for me, if you're just starting in with notes, you're going to screw everyone up. I'm going to screw everyone up. Let's let them have a shot and then we can do it. As far as emulating a style, I mean, it's hard to say, because I am in the military, Mike, and, I've been in leadership roles. And I have found, and this is just for me, I have found when you're screaming and yelling at everyone, you're going to get less that done than when you're being supportive and providing, like, you know, a guidance and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so, Mike.
Well, how about, yeah, Colonel? Why don't you refer him by his, you know, we're not dealing with any small potatoes either.
This is the real deal.
And we could do 10 hours on this interview when Josh lays on me psyops right at the, beginning here.
Also.
I mean, I think we're dealing with Dylan here. Might be just a little bit of an overachiever. No. I mean, Lieutenant Colonel in the military, then you're a director, you know, but outside of one casting error in the movie, I mean, pretty good stuff, you know? I'm sorry. Did that slip out? I'm terrible.
I think for being on set, I think you're just going to, I try to keep my sets as much as you can, like in a good vibe moving forward. Everyone's feeling, kind of a part of the team and friendly for all intents and purposes. It doesn't always work. I think mostly that works. Sometimes you do have to like dig into someone, unfortunately, but, so I know it's a style I emulate.
Are you a director that rehearses a lot before you shoot?
I don't think we ever have time. I don't think we ever have time. I think, especially indie film, like you hear about all this rehearsal, all the rehearsals and rehearsal time and all the stuff that people do. And I think those directors that you're talking about, like, I don't even know Scorsese does anymore, but like you're talking about massive studio directors that have all kinds of time for that actor to come for 2 months. Or it's fight heavy and they're like, let's spend a month doing this kind of fight choreography. I tried as much as I could, but, you know, Billy Zane, we had him for 5 days, had to shoot his stuff. Like, that's it. And we were fighting rain in Richmond for that whole exterior scene that we have. So it's like, what are you going to do? Now, John was very cool about, like, he came into town. He was there, going to be there the weekend before we started shooting. And I was like, hey, do you want to go up to the park? I just figured out what the fight choreography is going to be. Like, I had to map it out. In my head, and I wrote it all down.
Sorry, I'm laughing when you're talking about the fight choreography because I mean that's seriously
it's so dumb, right?
Funny,
it's
like, right there.
It looks like a real life fight. It looks like a real fight. Not
what do you mean? It looks like a real life fight. Have you ever been in a real life fight? What the fuck are you talking about?
First of all, language.
All
and
right.
Second of all, like when in high school, I've never been in a fight because I'm so lovely.
It's a lot of grappling.
But in high school, when there's going to be a fight after school,
fight, you don't do, ninja moves.
Well, yeah,
Rob.
But I'm talking about some of the missed shots and stuff like that.
I'm going to say this, and this is not a spoiler, but the Chad Dukes frontal attack on John, to me, is the most credible because I know a lot of fights that end like that.
I love it so much.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
like that
you see, Mike, credible. Okay. It is credible.
Yeah, I get it. I want to talk, and Rob, you'll like this too, because I want to talk about the music.
Oh my God, yes.
You know, and as a matter of fact, when you, as far as the comparisons go to John's mega hit, Napoleon Dynamite, that was one of the real wonderful things about the difference. The difference is the soundtrack. Mm-hmm. Did you have a lot to do with the soundtrack? Because it's banging. I
would buy this soundtrack. Yeah, absolutely.
I tried to Shazam the drum beat to figure out what song that is.
Right on. Mm-hmm.
Nothing
right,
came up.
So I got a lot to say about it. I do want to punctuate with the fight choreography in air quotes. I had to go and like we were supposed to go to dinner. I was like, I can't go to dinner. I got to draw this stuff out. And I wrote up 95 shots like over a weekend when I was supposed to be like doing stuff with my kid. Like, because I knew if I don't come in there with this sheet of paper that has all this stuff, the stunt coordinator is going to take over and he's going to do something. And it's not going to be kind of what I want with this dumb kind of stupid framing.
Yeah. Yeah, it wouldn't be silly enough, right? It wouldn't be silly enough. Yeah, I agree with you 100%. That's cool.
It would be something else. So as far as the music goes, let's see, in the drum beats and all that, first, you can get it on Spotify. It's available. Like, Jacob, our composer, put it up. We worked on all that together for hours of what we were going to do as far as the composition goes. I'll talk about the needle drops in a second, but the composition was really important to me. I started working on the needle drops like 6 months before we filmed because I knew it was going to take a long time. It took like 4 years to get
it. Now, just for layman's terms, needle drops would be the clips of music you're using for the various scenes.
Yes.
Right,
like, it took 4 to 5 years to get all the music. So I
wanted to ask a question about the money involved there, because I'd read that when Lucas did American Graffiti and the entire soundtrack is needle drops, But in the early 70s, he was buying records in perpetuity for $250, $300 that he could put on the soundtrack. Wow. How hard is the financial finagling to get like music from Rush and Queen? I mean, that's crazy.
It was not easy. It was not easy, especially where, you know, we're not a studio movie. We are an indie movie. Now, we had a decent budget, but we didn't have like studio money, right? We're not paying $250,000 for a song. At one point, I think I'm allowed to say this. I wanted an ELO piece for the end that I had like my heart set on. And I had to write Jeff Lynne and do all this stuff that I was like, is this really going to go anywhere? And eventually they said yes, but the price of the piece of music was studio money. And it was so much that it would have added, like quintupled our current budget of what we're spending. So
can you tell us what the needle drop was? What was the song?
It was do you want my love? Do you by ELO?
Do you want my love? Yeah. Okay, yeah. All right, okay.
And it's great. And
not turned to stone. Okay, yeah. I was just curious about that.
I guess Rupert Holmes not driving the hard bargain that ELO was, because I did like the use of the song Escape.
Yeah, thank you, thank you. No, look, a lot of it. They were, once you make that first deal, then you can kind of take that deal to everyone else. And they all want MFN. They all want Most Favored Nations, which just means you have to pay them the same as you're paying the first one. Mm-hmm. So they are willing to do that. It is a business for them. So they're like, all right, you want to license a song? Here it is. But they have their quotes on whatever it is. Maybe we got a little lucky with it being COVID. And for some reason, everyone thought we would never go outside again and no one would ever make a movie or anything again. So maybe we got a little bit of a better rate here and there, but when all is said and done, it was pretty expensive and painstaking and long and woof.
Yeah, no, I can imagine the whole process. Dylan Narang, director of Tappa Wingo, when you finished with this, and it, you know, you hear horror stories from directors about just, you know, that it's just it's a thankless job. It's a grueling job. It is a difficult thing to put this whole project together. Are you at the end of it, when you get done with the editing, when you see the final product, you know, what does that feel like for this particular film? Are you happy with everything that came out of this experience?
Yeah, look, I think... There's moments of happiness you have when we finished filming, when we got John, when we finished filming, when we finished post, when I got the a big song, when I got the last contract for the big song, which finally meant the movie was done, because for a while there, we were pushing forward and they hadn't sent us the contract.
Oh.
And it was moving towards our date. Like, we were supposed to release in August, where I was like, oh, great, it's a summer movie. It's gonna... And then we're, you know... Luckily, we got December 2nd, which is a good date for the holidays. But we were moving towards it, and we were still waiting on. There's a piece of music. Remember when one of the twins flips Will in the gym?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a classical piece of music. It's Shostakovich's second or something. That was a problem because we had it, and then we didn't have it, and then they were like, "Well, you still have it, but we got to figure out how you can get it. We have to talk to the heirs now." It was a whole thing that was holding up.
Oh, my God. The heirs, not the heirs of the composer.
Yeah.
So, wow. I would think classical music would be the easiest.
Well, no, I would think it would be based on the particular recording, you know, the Philharmonic that did that piece.
All of that is true, except for I think he passed away more recently. It has not been 70 years, so it's not public domain. So it's still owned by the
family. So it's early 1900s when a composer passes at that particular time.
If it is, then you're great. You want to use Mozart or Bach or Beethoven, you can do that. And then you just have to figure out who did the recording. But so the needle drops took a long, long time. Now, I had a lot of them already planned. Like when I kind of took my turn at the script, I was like, I should play this song here, and I want to play this song here, and this one would work really well here, and I want to play T-Rex here. And there was all these things that I just kind of knew I wanted to do. And I'm a big fan of 70s classic rock. So it made it easier.
I was surprised to hear Hocus Pocus.
Hocus Pocus. Okay.
It actually made me, and this is hard to do, to get me to like classic rock again after working at the Edge in Washington, D.C. when Kenny King ruined it for me. It was fun to, you know, reflect on it. Shows you how much time has gone, has been spent since I last listened to it. And it's just the use of it really, it's tough to do because we hear classic rock all the time. But this movie, the cuts were... obviously, you put some time and thought into it. It shows.
The one piece of music that I wish, well, look, wish or not, I had gotten Weird Al because I love Weird Al. And there was Dare to Be Stupid, which is like a beat track. It's really good. Yeah. It used in Transformers, a movie from 84, 85. I had that for the fight scene. Mm-hmm. And they gave it to us and we paid for it. And I had to map out, this is before we shot. So I had to kind of say in my head, how long is this scene going to go that I need the song for? So I told him, I think it's like 42 seconds. Mm-hmm. Hey, can we get 55? That should cover it. And we got like whatever, 55. And then the time came, we cut it and we put it together. And it was like, you needed a minute 15.
Oh.
And so I went back and said, hey, Weird Al's people, can we have the Weird Al song? And Weird Al's people said, you cannot have the Weird Al song for anymore. We're done. So it's not Weird Al's fault. It's just, that's what happened. I was like, I guess we don't have it. What am I going to do? It took me this long to find everything else, and I just clicked the computer and said classic rock, zany, and within a minute and a half I found Focus. Hocus Pocus by Focus. Like, it was so quick, and I had never heard it before. It was crazy.
It is a nutty song.
And we called their people and they were like, you're good, great, you got it, don't worry
about it. That's so cool.
This holiday season, what does comfort look like to you? For me, it's slowing down, finding calm amid the chaos, and making home a place where everyone can truly relax. That's where Avocado Green Mattress comes in. Avocado helps you create your own natural oasis, a calm, cozy space filled with certified organic comfort. Their handcrafted mattresses are designed for deeper, more restorative sleep, and their breathable pillows and soft organic bedding bring that same luxury to every part of your home. Hosting family this year, Avocado's sustainable furniture, like their beautifully made city bed frame, helps you create a warm, inviting space where everyone sleeps well and feels cared for. Everything Avocado makes is thoughtfully crafted with the planet in mind, certified organic, non-toxic, and built to last, so you can feel good about the comfort you bring into your home, because Avocado believes in being better for you and better for the planet. Prioritize rest and recharge with Avocado's organic comfort. Head to Avocado Green Mattress.com today to create your natural oasis and save big during their holiday sale. Avocado, dream of better.
That is really so easy.
So, Dylan, first of all, we appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. The movie begins its streaming on December 2nd. Is that when it starts?
Yes.
And for the foreseeable future, is it military? Is it movies? I mean, I would imagine both full-time military takes up a bit of your time.
I'm a reservist.
You're a reservist. Yes. Thank goodness. Okay. All right. That's good.
And we never talked baseball. So busy guy.
When you're coming out with a movie like this, an indie, as you said, an independent film, what is the barometer for success? What do you hope for the film Tapawingo? Oh, what are you looking for?
That's such
this?
A big question. Look,
it is a big question. I'm just curious about it.
I think this is going to sound so crass. I think making money back so that I can pay the investors would be good.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a sign of success. No. I think so. That, like, you gotta put on your little, you know, your ledger of what needs to happen. The other thing would be enough viewers and you know, people watching it, that all these guys that worked so hard on it, whether it's the, you know, whether it's the crew of the DP, the wardrobe, like Jared Russell or Sarah Kogan or Jacob, who's our composer, which Josh is the one to talk to about him. Like, all those guys, like, I want people to see the movie so they can say, oh, I want to hire these people. They know what they're doing.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, that would be good.
That's wonderful.
We have a bunch of good actors that, you know, everyone knows John Heder, Gina Gershon, and Billy, and Ratzenberger, and Amanda Verse for Married with Children. But all those other actors, the twins, Jay, Kim. Kim has been doing a lot of stuff. But
Is Kim Gretchen?
Yes.
Tell me just more about her, because I did not recognize her in the film. And I think she is one of the strongest parts of the film.
Oh,
she's
I agree.
Fabulous. Yeah, and in fact, you might be the best thing in it. Tell us about Kim real quick, and then we'll let you go.
We were having so much trouble finding the lead female. Like, we couldn't find it, couldn't figure out who it should
be.
And
so good.
Alan got this tape, and he sent it, and it was Kim. And he was like, dude, I think we found her. You need to watch this. And you could just tell she has comedy chops and a good understanding of what to do and how to do it in drama and everything. She's just so good at the whole thing, and her timing is so good. So once we got her, she was great on set, knew how to do everything, was willing to do all of the stuff, was physical. I think it also helped that the female character, hopefully, I mean, this comes across. I was trying not to do a female character that was, you know, just pining after a man or anything. Like, that character's supposed to have her own goals and objectives and is moving towards those goals and objectives and is kind of will do what she needs to get those goals and objectives, that isn't, using her body or any of that to do it. Like, it's all, she's supposed to feel like a real person and a real character, what they would be. And Kim is just great at doing that. Now, since then, she was on L.A. to Vegas, which was a short show, which was a comedy that only lasted like one season. I saw some of it and I was like, oh, this is really good. She should be known. And then after us, she did the SNL movie.
She played Jane Curtin, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I would urge anybody watching Tapawingo to watch her in the trash bin scene. That's when I fell in love with the character. Rob, we only have a few seconds left.
I just want to give you one compliment before we go, and it came to me during
this.
There's
always time for that, Rob.
When you talked about how you would sketch out every shot before you did it because of the efficiency of getting the movie done, the only other director of fame that I know that did it that way was Hitchcock. And he did it because he didn't want people to screw with his product after the fact, largely. But also, it is the most efficient way to get your vision on the screen. So when Mike asks what director, you know, you aspire to be or inspired you, whether or not you like it, I mean, that's very Hitchcockian of you. And that's about the biggest praise I can heap.
Yeah, look, I love Hitchcock. I knew that about him. I don't know if that's where I got the idea. I just know when I was at film school doing it, I was like, this is not going to work unless I can see all of the cuts and what's going to happen, because otherwise you're going to miss a shot. So thank you. It's very kind of you.
Dylan, thanks so much for taking the time. I wish you the very best of luck with Tapawingo and for your next project, whatever it is. If you need a mid-60s character actor who starred in 1979 in A Streetcar Named Desire as Mitch, I'm available and would love to help in any way I can. I can't do an interview with anybody associated with film without something self-serving. That's just the way I roll. Congratulations. Thanks for taking the time, and good luck with Tapawingo, Dylan. We appreciate it.
Thank you all. Thank you. See ya.